Georgia's DBHDD reminds people that the Good Samaritan Law can save lives during alcohol and drug overdoses. People are urged to call 911 and stay until help arrives. More information at opioidresponse.info.
Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nigut, and as always, I'm very glad to have all of you with us for our show today. If you've been listening to GPB Radio already this morning, you know that we began our fall pledge drive today, which means that a couple times during the show today, we're going to take brief pledge breaks to give people who are not helping support the work we do here an opportunity to do that. If you already do, I'm always grateful to you. I know some of you feel like, oh, we don't need these pledge breaks, but they are exactly what keeps us going. At the same time, I want you to know that our management people understand how much Political Rewind means to all of you, and so we have much longer segments than other shows on our air have today because they want to make sure you get real content on this show. Enough said about that. We'll talk more about Pledge as the week goes by. It's Tuesday, which means Tamar Hallerman, senior reporter for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, is with us. Hello, Tamar. How you doing?
Hey, Bill. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, we're going to talk in a minute about a wonderful story that you filed this weekend about your visit to a COVID ward at a Savannah hospital. And I'm really... The AJC has been doing just a spectacular job bringing the virus, the consequences of COVID home to people. We've tried doing the same thing with our team here, but your piece is wonderful, and I look forward to talking about it in a few minutes. We're also joined today by Tammy Greer. Tammy Greer, professor of political science at Clark Atlanta University. Tammy, you talk about yourself as being a civic education and civic engagement enthusiast. What does that mean to you?
That means that I am enthusiastically passionate about civic engagement and participation and the impact that it has on all of our lives. And my goal is to get others to be just as enthusiastic about it as I am.
Oh, well, that's great. I'm really happy to have you back on the show with us. So thanks for being here today. Tamar, let's start with COVID news. First of all, we set a record in the number of deaths reported for one day in Georgia yesterday, which is awful enough. But the Associated Press is now reporting that COVID-19, this is kind of staggering, Tamar. COVID-19 has now killed more Americans than the 1918-1919 Spanish flu pandemic, which killed about 675,000 plus people who have now died of this virus. I think when this all began and we started hearing about the flu epidemic, no one in their wildest imagination thought we would exceed that with COVID.
Yeah, I wrote a story in April of last year kind of comparing Georgia's response to COVID to Spanish flu. And I just thought, okay, this is a fun little novelty story. But no, it's insane all the parallels that there are and how people, you could see when they imposed restrictions back in 1918, and how initially people were willing to follow it. But at some point, people got so frustrated and the state didn't want to reimpose restrictions. So certainly a sad milestone. And you're right, Bill, we had this on the front page of our paper today. 191 confirmed COVID deaths reported Monday, which is a record. The previous record was set in February, and it was 186. And that was without widespread availability of vaccines. So a grim milestone, and one that when you talk to medical providers, they remind you that a lot of this was preventable.
Yeah, exactly. We should point out that, nevertheless, incidents of COVID-19 are, in fact, continuing to decrease here, which is good news, but we're still paying the price for the rampant infections that we've had over the past weeks and beyond. Tammy, let's talk about the politics of this. We know that misinformation, disinformation, has prevented a lot of people from being vaccinated or taking other mitigating measures to prevent the virus. And now U.S. Senate candidate Herschel Walker joins that number. He sent out a tweet the other day essentially supporting Nicki Minaj, who is a huge international music star. She put out a tweet, we know, in which she made some really, really ridiculous claim about a friend of a cousin who had this severe reaction to taking the vaccine, enlarged swollen testicles. It led to his engagement being discontinued. It was an absurd tweet. And yet Herschel Walker said this: "Hey, Nicki Minaj, it's always okay to ask questions. It should be encouraged to be inquisitive in order to make sure we're putting our country's best interests at heart. Thank you for speaking out." Tammy?
Yeah, so outliers always happen. So there's always going to be something on an extreme where you see that there could be an extreme reaction depending on the individual. So we don't know the background of the individual. We don't know how the people react to a vaccine. That being said, when you take it all inclusively, we see that there are enormous benefits. And so we can all latch on to, you know, things that co-sign our feelings about an issue. At the same time, when we look at it in its totality, the lives that have been saved because of should be the focus and not an outlier such as that.
Tamar, what's troubling to me as I read the tweet is that more than ever we now see that how people respond to COVID, whether they get vaccinated or not, becomes an issue in political races in 2022.
Yeah, nothing's immune from politics. Even, you know, a rapper who's really, you know, you go to the dance club and you dance to Nicki Minaj. But she's also somebody with a massive, massive platform. She has 23 million followers on Twitter. You know, she speaks to an audience that's younger, a lot of people of color. And this is an audience that the government really needs to reach to get more people to get vaccinated, because younger people are not as vaccinated as they need to be. So you saw the White House kind of jump at the opportunity to talk to Nicki Minaj. Anthony Fauci has commented on it, about it, and suggested that it might not be true, that this guy might just have an STD, he might have chlamydia, and just this is so third hand, kind of this information that Nicki Minaj is getting, and spreading it to 23 million followers can be really dangerous. And so the White House, I know, has tried to reach out to her. But yeah, every person counts, and it kind of goes to show how one kind of influencer can really make it hard to spread that message.
Tamar, tell us about your visit to Memorial Health University Medical Center in Savannah. They've had a crush of COVID-19 cases there. Most of us just see it from a distance. You walked through the hospital hallways where they're treating COVID. Tell us a little bit about that visit.
You know what? What really struck me walking through the COVID wards was how quiet it was, actually. I was expecting gurneys crowding the hallway and the waiting room and sick patients spilling out into the hallways and the parking lots, like what we saw in New York earlier in the pandemic. And that was not it. It was very quiet. It seemed quite orderly. There was no running or screaming or shouting or administering CPR to patients everywhere. But talking to the nurses there, they're saying, actually, you know, this is organized chaos. The scenes that were happening behind every closed door in every patient room was really, really dire. And there were more people there. They were sicker. They were staying for longer. They were younger and battling more severe symptoms. And so to kind of hear that and just the sheer exhaustion from some of these doctors and nurses, many of whom had been at it for 18 months on the COVID floor. And some of them were hoping, you know, there's a point this summer where they only had one COVID patient and they thought, maybe we've reached the light at the end of the tunnel. Maybe we're finally done with this. And how quickly things can get really overwhelmed. And there's points in the hospital where, you know, the day I was there, they were diverting ambulances and telling them to go elsewhere because they were running out of bed space. And that's a really depressing state to be in.
You quote Amber Dixon, a respiratory therapist at the hospital. She said to you, "It's not something I would ever wish on my worst enemy. Our days are very long. And to put it bluntly, we see a lot of death tomorrow."
Yeah. And thankfully, there's dedicated people like her who still kind of push through and do it. And Memorial Health is a well-resourced hospital. They have more money and more space than almost anywhere. And yet they're very much struggling to hang on and deal with the surge of patients. So we're kind of in a tenuous spot. And as you mentioned, case counts are better than what they were right after Labor Day. But I think a lot of people are scared about the fall. What happens now that we have all these people gathering for football games? Once gatherings go inside, kids in school, and it's an open question whether they can handle so much more.
Tammy, before I've got to get to a break, you know, we hear Herschel Walker raising doubts about the vaccine, or at least lending his name to the possible reasons for doubting the vaccine. On the other hand, we have to say it's interesting, especially in terms of reaching the African-American community, which has been skeptical of being that portion of it that's been skeptical of being vaccinated. Governor Kemp announced something pretty interesting yesterday. He's got a partnership now with my old colleague and friend, Monica Kaufman Pearson, who is probably the best known African-American television personality in Georgia, who is going to be working with him to encourage vaccines among all people. That's a promising sign, it seems to me, Tammy.
It is a promising sign. It's late in the game. It's a promising sign, though. So in addition to the vaccine, as we've been told by medical experts, masking is also important. So I think the message of all-inclusiveness is critical, especially if we want to turn things around, particularly here in Georgia.
All right. I've got to get to our break. You were going to start the pledge drive on our show right now. If you already help support Political Rewind, thank you for everything you've done for us. If not, we do need you. Our show is paid for by your donations. Our team, Sam Burmistaws, Jesse Neiswanger, our senior producer position, which right now is open, all and me, you support our work. You allow us to do what we do. So in any way that you can be of help to us, please do. Here's how you can do it. Welcome back to Political Rewind. Tamar Hallerman is with us. So is Tammy Greer, political science professor at Clark Atlanta University. It's a big week for news on the abortion front. Tamar, Friday, the federal appeals court here in North Georgia will take up the stay that's been placed on the Georgia abortion law, which all but outlaws abortion in the state. It's been stayed until the court can explored the law more fully. So that's happening this week. The Supreme Court has now announced its schedule for taking up the Mississippi abortion law. That'll happen in early December. So that's happening. But then tomorrow, even more immediately, the new Texas law is going to be challenged quickly. Two men, a man from Arkansas and Illinois, have both filed lawsuits against the Texas doctor who announced, because he wanted to take this to court, that he had performed an abortion on a woman whose pregnancy had exceeded the six-week limit before an abortion would be, when abortion would then be illegal. I didn't even know, Tamar, that you could be from out of state and challenge this.
Yeah, and what's so unique about this law is not only does it outlaw abortion after 6 weeks, but it lets private citizens sue anyone who aids and abets an abortion. And the fear for many people is that it could unleash a wave of lawsuits that could not only challenge the doctors that would perform a procedure, but even, you know, the cab driver who drives a woman to her appointment, or a family member who might pitch in to pay for the procedure. And what's so interesting about these two lawsuits or that people who have sued this abortion provider in Texas, yeah, neither one of them lives in state. And one of them says they're pro-choice. They want to test it. And the other one is a disbarred lawyer who wants $10,000. So yeah. I think it'll be a real test of this.
Boy, Tammy, you know, you say that your areas of interest, especially now, are civic engagement. You couldn't ask for an issue that can spark more civic engagement than both the pro and anti-abortion forces, Tammy.
That's right. And what's interesting to me is when you look at polling data about this issue, state by state or even across the country, you see that there is more support for women to have the ability to have bodily autonomy. Yet and still, when it comes to voting for those individuals, elected officials within the states who have the ability to make such laws, that part is lacking. So we really need to connect these particular issues that we're most passionate about with electing officials that actually mimic our own individual needs and desires for what elected officials are to do. So it'll be very interesting to see. And I've seen information that has that that Republicans in particular are concerned that these laws against women's bodily autonomy could have a negative impact in elections for Republicans. We'll see if that actually comes to fruition here in this year and in midterm elections next year, particularly in Texas and in Georgia, since those governors are up for re-election next year.
You know, it's interesting, Tammy, that although the polling always shows that more people in this state, across country, are pro-choice than are anti-abortion, at the same time, when a legislative body in Georgia meets, it is dominated by Republican legislators. They have the majority, clearly, and they are following the will of their Republican, their, in many cases, conservative Republican constituents. So when Brian Kemp and Speaker David Ralston, session before last, wanted to move forward with a modified abortion bill, they could not get support from their members because constituents were pushing them harder and harder to the right until we get to this point where abortion, if the law is eventually upheld by the courts, virtually outlawed here, Tammy.
Sure. While I take the point that they were listening to the constituents, they were listening to constituents who were the loudest voices in the room. So not necessarily a coalition of constituents in their particular districts. At the same time, if we're only looking for those particular, only looking at those, then we're not looking at the state as a whole. And sometimes that's where we can get some challenges if we're only looking at individual districts rather than the state as a whole.
And you talk about Governor Kemp and some of his allies in the legislature as they were drafting what became the heartbeat bill and how ultimately they really turned to the right on this issue. And that's because, I mean, on both sides, abortion is such an animating issue for segments of the base. And so it's kind of harder to appeal to the middle when you're most, the people that you need to stay on your side feel so strongly about an issue. It's hard to appeal to the middle on that. And Bill, you do mention how overall the majority of the public supports bodily autonomy for women, but then you talk about kind of individual restrictions on that, not fully outlawing it. But then when you talk about abortions in the third trimester, when you start kind of going week by week and month by month, it quickly becomes a murkier picture. And that's why a lot of conservative states have been able to chip away at Roe versus Wade over the years and how we've kind of gotten to this point, because the public, it's not as cut and dry as pro-abortion or anti-abortion.
I think you make a very important point. Yes, there are modifications that states have made to abortion that have had an impact on women who feel they must have an abortion. And you can look at the difference between Roe, which was what gave states the right to enact abortion or said abortion was constitutional and legal in this country. And then look at Casey a number of years later. There was a modification right there that abortion was only permissible up until the viability of the fetus, Tammy. So, right, that was a very dramatic change and a chipping away of abortion rights, Tammy.
Sure, and yet now we're saying not after 6 weeks, and there's no viability after 6 weeks. So it's fascinating to see, particularly in Texas, how the way to get around the constitutionality or the decision by the court for viability is that we're not going to make it criminal. We're just going to do it from a civic action standpoint, which, as we know, is a lesser bar than a criminal bar. At the same time, I think it's critically important that we all understand that restrictions on women's bodily autonomy has a deep impact, not only on that particular woman. It has a deeper impact on her family, on her community, on her economic status. It has long-term impact. And I don't know if we're really diving into those particular aspects and going to the extreme of, you know, aborting a fetus at 9 months, right? Which is absurd to say that someone is supporting of that, just as we talked about previously with, you know, the person who had an adverse reaction to the vaccine, so to speak. So we're taking extremes on many different issues and then putting them inside of the conversation as if that is normal, and it's not. And we really have to, you know, refocus. And I would challenge all of us that some of those extremes not to give too much air to, because that murkies and muddies the issue overall.
Tamara, we should put this in the context of Georgia very specifically. Butch Miller has already said that he is likely to introduce a Texas-style abortion bill here in the Georgia legislature during the next session. So our legislators are very likely going to be confronted with the same kind of measure tomorrow.
Sure, but let's also put this into context. Butch Miller is running for lieutenant governor, and he has a pretty, you know, he's got a strong primary challenge coming up from Burt Jones. So they're both going to be racing to the right to try and appeal to that base, just as we were talking about, that's firmly anti-abortion. What'll be interesting to see between now and then is how these lawsuits in Texas unfold. Are we going to see bounty hunters incentivized by this law and the $10,000 reward, I guess, that you get if you win a lawsuit against against some of these defendants? What sort of unintended consequences are we going to see because of that? And will we get people like Butch Miller to answer for that? Or is it still a 100% winning issue with your base?
We should point out, though, within that context, that the Texas physician who performed this abortion wrote a piece about it for The Washington Post. In other words, he wanted to be challenged on this, giving an abortion to a woman past the six-week threshold. We are told that abortion providers in Texas, almost across the board, have stopped performing abortions. And so that in and of itself, Tamar, is for women who feel they must have abortions, is giving them no options unless they leave the state.
Exactly. It's had a real chilling effect. And this doctor in his Washington Post op-ed talks about a mother of four who's 42 years old, who was looking for an abortion. And he said, "I'll pay to send you to Oklahoma where you can still get an abortion." And she says, "I don't have time for that. Who's going to watch my kids? Who's going to work my job? I need those wages." And so there's going to be countless cases like that that we might not hear as much about in the media.
All right. Thank you for that conversation to both of you. We got to get to another pledge break. We'll have more with our panel after these messages. Say, Clark Atlanta University political science professor Tammy Greer, I thought about you a little while ago when I was reading The Jolt to the AJC this morning. Stacey Abrams has begun her national book tour. She was in San Antonio last night, and among the things she said was this quote from Greg Bluestein, who was there for the start of the tour. Abrams said, quote, "The world is going to impact us one way or another. I'd rather be in the arena shaping the outcome. I'd rather be part of the doing than a part of the done unto. You know what you need already. Voting is about making sure your voice is heard and about shaping the vision of what we want to see." You know, whether you're a Stacey Abrams supporter or a Republican who really, really opposes what she stands for, you have to, I think, on either side of the aisle, say that Stacey Abrams has had enormous impact on acting out just that statement, getting people engaged as voters in this state.
I agree. You know, part of being a full citizen in this country is participating in the electoral process. And if it takes, you know, someone to have the audacity to be the first Black woman to be at the top of the ticket in a race for a governor, or the audacity to be the first Black woman to have the chance of being the first governor of any state in these United States, and to have that type of electricity behind you, it's critical. At the same time, you know, such change in being the arena means that we as citizens must be fully engaged on a daily basis, because part of having this democracy to perform the way that works for all is for all of us to get into that game. So I completely agree.
Tamar?
Yeah, I mean, Stacey Abrams has definitely taken her show on the road, as you mentioned, a tour around the country to promote a lot of the books that she's written over the last couple of years. And no stops in Georgia yet, as Republicans like to point out. But she certainly doesn't have to rush. Even, you know, everyone's expecting her to jump in on this gubernatorial race, but, you know, she doesn't have any other Democrats, or at least any prominent ones, who are kind of nipping at her heels waiting to challenge her. She has sky-high name recognition. This national tour is only going to help with that. It's only going to help with her fundraising should, you know, if and when she chooses to jump in. So she certainly seems to kind of be soaking it all in before what we think will be another run for office.
Yeah. Tamar, by the way, speaking of books, we've now learned that Brad Raffensperger has a book contract too. He is going to have a book published by Simon & Schuster. It'll be out in early November. It's called Integrity Counts. Simon & Schuster describes the book as Raffensperger's inspiring story of commitment to the integrity of American democracy. And they say that Raffensperger speaks out against the former president's false claims of voter fraud in the 2020 elections. Now, Tamar, you're welcome to weigh in on the book that he is writing. But at the same time, this is a good opportunity to point out that just last Friday, President Trump has written a letter saying that the Georgia election, the fraudulent Georgia election, needs to be decertified because there's new evidence that shows that fraud was a part of this election. And that letter went to the Secretary of State's office. So maybe Brad Raffensperger is going to get some unexpected public relations help for this book tomorrow.
Yeah, I mean, and it's certainly furthering the brand that he's kind of burnished for himself over the last 9-10 months since the election. I mean, not only is he sort of taking a tough stand against Trump, but he's also going after people like Stacey Abrams for not conceding the governor's race in 2018. So we know that he talks about that in his book. And it also says a lot about the people who he is allying himself with in this period where he does not have a ton of friends in the Republican Party in Georgia anyway. And one of the people named in the book blurb is former California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, a Republican who has been critical of Trump and kind of a lot of stuff going on in the party. And he calls Brad Raffensperger a true democracy action hero. And his group, you know, gave hundreds of thousands of dollars in grant money to Georgia counties for election administration. So it says a lot about where Brad Raffensperger sees himself in the political landscape at the moment. It's not necessarily dissimilar from Jeff Duncan, as he, you know, as he makes the rounds selling his book, GOP 2.0. Both of them are kind of in the doghouse with a lot of members of the Republican base here in Georgia. But these books will certainly get their names out to a more national audience.
Tammy, in the letter that former President Trump sent to Brian Kemp and to Secretary of State Raffensperger, he said that both of them, he accused them of fighting so hard that the election truth not be told. And in the letter, he sent a report of what he claimed were 43,000 absentee ballots that violated chain of custody rules. His quote, "I would respectfully request that your department check this, and if true, along with many other claims of voter fraud and voter irregularities, start the process of decertifying the 2020 election, or whatever the correct legal remedy is, and announce the true winner." I mean, and Tammy, this comes, you know, we're almost a year after the election.
So this is on brand for the former president, right? So the former president attempted to defraud the country by stating that former President Barack Obama was not a citizen and not born in the United States. So because of that, and so he had mountains of evidence for, you know, to support that claim. There are many claims over the past, you know, decade that the former President Trump has made. So the Secretary of State and the governor of Georgia are both in a very precarious position at this moment, because if they ignore the claims made by the former president, then it looks as if they are dismissing any kind of claims of voter irregularities. Yet if they continue to do investigations, then they're spending taxpayer dollars in order to go down a rabbit hole that will come up to be fruitless. So it's very interesting, the position that both are in, being that originally they both were tied to the former president. And only until this particular issue with the election did there appear to be some sort of a separation. So it's very interesting, and I am very curious as to how both are going to handle this situation, being that, you know, you can't feed the situation and then try to take it back, because that's where we run into some challenges.
This all happens on a week when, number one, tomorrow, Donald Trump Jr. will be in the state to stump for a lieutenant governor candidate, Burt Jones, who former President Trump has already endorsed for that position. And then the big show, when Trump himself goes to Perry to mount a massive rally. The reporting now has it that this is going to be an all-day affair. Trump won't be there until the evening, but apparently conservative Republican Georgians will be showing up in Perry. They're going to have a UGA game-watching party in the afternoon, and it will be tomorrow Herschel Walker's debut as a candidate for U.S. Senate. He went to the UGA game on opening day at home, but he didn't make any remarks as a declared candidate. In this rally, that will happen tomorrow.
Yeah, exactly. He's made a couple appearances on, you know, very friendly Republican shows on places like Fox News. But you're right, very much a public debut. It'll be interesting to hear his stump speech and kind of the issues he focuses on, because in general, so far, he's talked a lot about himself and his background, but less about his specific policy views. So it'll be interesting to see how Trumpy and sharp-elbowed he is, or if he tries to frame himself as the unifier. And as you mentioned, an all-day Trump fest, UGA game, but also all the candidates who Trump has endorsed, or, you know, at least aligned himself with. We have Burt Jones running for LG, Congressman Jody Heiss running for Secretary of State, and Marjorie Taylor Greene is also on the agenda. So I'm sure we'll get lots of great tidbits from my colleagues covering that event.
Of course, Tammy, we should point out that when Trump holds a rally, you may be a person standing on the stage or maybe near the stage and be somebody he endorses. But if you were Kelly Loeffler or David Perdue running for Senate in the 2020 election, when Trump came presumably to support your candidacies, you learned quickly that what he was really there to do was talk about himself, Tammy.
Right. And not only that, I caution candidates to look at the longer game, because the longer game when we're looking at statewide election is that, you know, the state is not as friendly to the former president as the state was in 2016. So the demographics have shifted, the new folks coming into the state has made statewide races more competitive. And even though the former president is going to get on stage and boast about self, and you think that you're going to get some face time to discuss or to get the crowd on your side, that may not take place. And even if you have that opportunity, the folks that that are solidly in your corner are those that are dwindling in the numbers inside of the state of Georgia. So when we talk about the extremes and really needing to go to the middle, Georgia is that competitive state that, particularly for statewide races, you need to go to the middle.
Tamara?
At the same time, at this point, you know, they've got to get through a primary first, and having Trump in your corner is extremely helpful with the base, where, you know, here in Georgia, he still is overwhelmingly popular, something like 85% popularity among Republicans. So I certainly think it helps somebody like Burt Jones or Jody Heiss to be in that picture with Donald Trump. Where it gets harder is once we start turning to the general election, and that's where David Perdue and Kelly Loeffler really struggled with Trump not talking about them.
Yeah, I think that's an important point, Tammy. You want to win a primary, but pivoting after Trump has supported you, as you point out, in a state as purple as Georgia is, makes your life in the general much trickier, Tammy.
It's much trickier. And not only is it much trickier for the candidate, it brings it back to the people who vote or who are hesitant to vote in the general election because they feel like they have extreme candidates on both ends. So the primaries produce extreme candidates as the successor. And then when we get to the general election, then people really have the thought process of choosing between two quote-unquote evils because they're at the polar opposite. So this is, you know, yeah.
I'm sorry, Tammy Greer. I didn't mean to cut you short there, but I do appreciate it. And the reason I'm a little abrupt is I do have to end the show a little early today to get to our final pledge break. But Professor Tammy Greer, really glad you came back. And I hope you'll continue to join us for Political Rewind. Tamara Hallerman, I'll see you again next Tuesday and continue reading your stuff in the AJC. That's it for us today. But let me say, as I throw it to the pledge break, you know, we have now been with you for 18 months of the pandemic, 5 days a week. We've been covering the pandemic. We've been covering the remarkable politics that have unfolded as Georgia has become one of the most important political states in the country. And we're going to continue to be here for you 5 days a week. And we would appreciate it if you would help us make this show work day in and day out by making a pledge. And you can do that right now. And here's how you can do it. In the meantime, I'll be back with a new show tomorrow. Take care. Stay healthy. Wear your mask. Not only make sure you've been vaccinated for COVID, but CDC says you can get your flu shot at the same time. You don't have to worry about them conflicting with one another. So do that. See you tomorrow.